and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
Folks get real quiet when we ask them to provide some of the specifics.
Mayor Johnson bats down concerns over efficiencies as budget hearings wrap up.
How would you want your children to be taken care of if this were you?
A look at how a group of volunteers is helping kids get to school amid ICE raids. And Ken Burns joins us to talk about the ultimate epic, his new documentary about the American Revolution. First off tonight, SNAP recipients will finally begin to receive full benefits within a week now that the country's longest government shutdown is over. The state says it's working as quickly as it can to issue payments.
We had to make major adjustments in SNAP to try to meet the various levels of SNAP funding allowed by the courts. Right, originally it was zero, went to 50%, 65%, back to 50%, though some people weren't going to get any at all. Now we're back to 100%. So we're working as fast as we can to make sure that people have their SNAP cards charged and ready to go.
The Illinois Department of Human Services says the remaining benefits from recent partial payments will be made starting tomorrow. All recipients should receive full benefit payments by November 20th. Nearly 2 million Illinois residents, including 900,000 in Cook County, rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, to feed themselves and their families. Reverend Jesse Jackson remains in the hospital this evening. The 84-year-old civil rights icon is reportedly at Northwestern Memorial Hospital under observation for progressive supranuclear palsy, a rare neurological disorder. In a statement, the Rainbow Push Coalition said, quote, he has been managing this neurodegenerative condition for more than a decade. He was originally diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. However, last April, his PSP condition was confirmed. The family appreciates all prayers at this time. Reverend Jackson has been wheelchair-bound and receiving round-the-clock care at home from relatives in recent months, including sons Jonathan and Jesse Jr. A daycare worker is out of federal custody after being detained by federal immigration agents at the preschool where she worked. The video of Diana Santiana Galeano's arrest at the Rayito del Sol Spanish Immersion Daycare was widely shared online, as she can be heard in the video telling agents that she has papers. A federal judge agreed with her attorneys that her detention without a bond hearing is unlawful. Federal prosecutors have been given to or been ordered to schedule a bond hearing by next Tuesday. Attorneys for Santiana Galeano say they will continue to pursue her immigration claims to allow her to stay in the U.S. There's more of this story on our website. Up next, after budget hearings, what is the state of the mayor's plan? And are new taxes on the way? It's right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Negotiations over Chicago's 2026 budget are coming down to the wire with no easy fixes in sight. Major parts of Mayor Brandon Johnson's $16.6 billion budget for 2026 remain in flux, even as officials scheduled crucial votes on the spending plan for Monday. So our Heather Chiron joins us now with more. Heather, so even as these departmental budget hearings are set to wrap on Thursday, there's still no clear consensus on the bulk of the mayor's proposal to tax the city's wealthiest residents and biggest firms to the tune of $617 million. Where does the debate stand?
Well, older people had hoped a report from consulting firm Ernst & Young would give them a roadmap out of this quagmire to detail ways to make cuts that would not impact city services. But that report would only make changes that would result in significant savings for the city in future years, leaving the older people forced to decide whether to impose a $21 per month per employee tax on the city's largest firm or make deeply unpopular cuts. As the Budget Committee Chairman Alderman Jason Urban often says, everyone wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
So some city council members, they have called for at least some of those tax hikes to be replaced by cuts. Here's the mayor responding to those calls on Monday morning. Of course, this is after that first snowfall of the season.
We hear a lot of calls for cuts. And people like to refer to them as efficiencies. But folks get real quiet when we ask them to provide some of the specifics. Chicagoans do not want to see our snow plowing reduced. They do not want to see less workers out there working in the night so that their mornings can be better.
Heather, why are officials finding it so hard to reduce city spending?
Well, no one has proposed cutting even a single dollar from the proposed $2.1 billion budget for the Chicago Police Department. And that accounts for one-third of the entire discretionary fund the city council gets to decide how to spend. Add in the other public safety departments, you're talking about half of that discretionary fund. With putting all of that money off limits, significant cuts are hard to come by.
So the federal government shutdown is over, but the agreement to reopen the federal government, it blew an unexpected $10 million hole in the mayor's budget plan. What happened?
Well, Mayor Johnson wanted to tax the sale of intoxicating hemp products, $2 per item, and ban the sale to those under 21. But the bill signed by President Donald Trump on Wednesday bans that entire industry, making it unlikely the city is going to see that $10 million anytime soon.
And we know last year's budget negotiations stretched deep into December. Is that going to happen again?
Well, we'll know more on Monday when the administration is scheduled two crucial votes by two city council committees. If they have the votes, they'll vote. If they don't, they'll delay. Which means that if they do vote, maybe the budget will be adopted by Thanksgiving, almost a month earlier than last year.
All right. Heather Sharone, you'll have your eyes on it for us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website, all at WTTW.com/news. Over the last 2 months, many Chicagoans have taken it upon themselves to protect their communities from the rise in federal immigration enforcement in the city. There have been whistle workshops aimed at mobilizing and safeguarding neighborhoods. And as our Joanna Hernandez reports, there are dedicated volunteers who've initiated a program to walk kids to school.
So we're going to pick up Daniel first. Then our next stop is Rebecca.
Meet Alyssa May. She's one of the volunteers for an initiative called the Walking School Bus.
I'm going to go ahead and message the chat just so that way Jessica's mom knows that we're on the way so she can get her all dressed up with the snow.
May runs one of the daily walking routes for an elementary school in Albany Park, stepping in to help parents who are afraid to leave their home to take their kids to school. The parents we spoke with asked us not to identify the school because of concerns over ongoing immigration enforcement.
Now, you talked about there being different routes. How many kids do you think in all are being picked up?
I think at least 80, if not closer to 100, but it depends day by day.
Despite Chicago's first winter storm of the season,
we get to experience the first snow with them.
This dedicated group of volunteers are making sure these children arrive at school safely.
The moment that the raids started happening and people started getting pulled off the street, you could just see it. You could see less students, less families, less vendors. And it really did change. It just became a really quiet place.
In response, parents, educators, and neighbors decided to step up.
It has been a lot to get this underway and like up and running, but I've had so many staff members, so many community members step in and help, like, how can I help you with the apps? How can I help you with scheduling? How can I help you with the routes?
Teacher Dulce Jimenez says the walking school bus gives kids some sense of normalcy.
With getting them to know these volunteers, I've started to see all of these students show up, and a lot of their conversation at school is like, yo estoy viniendo con mis amigos, like, yo conozco a Miss Maggie, yo conozco a todos los voluntarios que están en nuestras rutas, and noticing and kind of not even realizing the distraction that was created and what we are trying to close off for them.
It's a growing movement among Chicago residents taking action to resist and protect their communities from Midway Blitz operations.
It is really very heartening to see just how much we will all show up to be a part of making sure that all of our kids are safe, that all of our people are safe.
May says volunteering her time is the right thing to do.
You could kind of sense a pickup, the fear of some of the kids of like, will I come home to an empty house? And we still have to sit with that and know that that is a reality, but at least they are getting one bright, simple SWAT every day.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
And for more about the walking school bus or to learn how to volunteer, please visit our website for more information. Up next, filmmaker Ken Burns and his co-producer on the new epic project, The American Revolution. Stay with us.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices.
The American Revolution, a new film from Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, and David Schmidt, tells the extraordinary story of the birth of the United States. But if you think you're familiar with that story, think again. More than 9 years in the making, this six-part, 12-hour documentary series tells the tale of the country's founding struggle from viewpoints you haven't seen before. It begins with a reminder that the United States we now know was not the first nation here.
Long before 13 British colonies made themselves into the United States, the six nations of the Iroquois Confederacy, Seneca, Cayuga, Onondaga, Tuscarora, Oneida, and Mohawk, had created a union of their own that they called the Haudenosaunee, a democracy that had flourished for centuries.
Joining us now with more about this monumental project are filmmakers Ken Burns and Sarah Botstein. Welcome to Chicago Tonight. Glad to have you both here.
It's great to be back. Thank
Congrats
you.
Congrats on this massive project is not quite the word
it's
to cover
it. It's been a long time.
I'm sure it has. So as we just heard, you begin with a different confederation of states. Not so much the colonies that we know become the United States, but specifically Native American nations that long predated the American Revolution. How important was it to begin with that context, Ken Burns?
Well, I think, you know, what we're taught in grammar school is that the American Revolution is about taxes and representation. And that's true, but it's also about Native American land. And I thought it was interesting as we learn more and more about it that Benjamin Franklin had himself been inspired by the Haudenosaunee, this Iroquois Confederacy, and their model that had worked for a long time as a model for the United States. And he convened seven of the 13 colonies in Albany, drew a picture of a snake cut into pieces under the dire warning, join or die. And then we just realized maybe that shouldn't be in the body of the film, but maybe at the very beginning, so that we could realize that what the revolution is a world war, a civil war, and a war essentially over the prize of North America. And what is the prize? This land. And that land is already occupied by 13 British colonies, superimposed over the land of of Native nations. And to the west are many more Native nations that are extraordinarily complicated groups, each individual, and as different from one another as, say, France is from Belgium. And we wanted to make sure that was understood, that at the heart, that this is about moving into this new space and claiming it for our own.
It is about so much more than many of us really remember. And many people don't fully appreciate, once you get into the war part, right, just how savage that conflict is. Here's a clip discussing the aftermath of the Battle of Bunker Hill in June of 1775.
It's four of the most awful hours of combat in American military history. There are 1,000 British casualties that day. There are 220-some British dead.
40% of the attacking force was killed or injured. 40%. That's horrendously high casualty rate. It is the highest casualty rate for the British Army until the first day of the Somme in 1916. It is unbelievably bloody.
Sarah Botstein, we hear from one expert who says part of the Revolutionary War or part of the revolutionary history has been sanitized. Mm-hmm. What are we misunderstanding or forgetting about the revolution?
Well, I think, you know, we forget that the American Revolution is at least two things happening at the same time. One is this huge revolution of ideas and how a government might be structured and who might lead that government and who might be responsible in selecting who rules that government. And the other is a terribly brutal, very complicated, as Ken was just saying, 18th century war. An 18th century war is really terrible and awful and bloody and scary and violent and dark. And in order to really understand our founding story, I think you really have to braid the two together. You have to understand the revolution for this war of ideas and ideals, and then the war that was fought for those ideals and principles to have a run.
Ken, in other conversations, you've talked about democracy being sort of an unintended consequence of the revolution. What do you mean by that?
So the idea is, first of all, there's a quarrel between Englishmen that gets broken out into natural rights. It's the Enlightenment. So they're thinking of arguments about why Britain is wrong, and all of a sudden they're no longer saying, well, you said this and we deserve this, but human beings themselves, by being human beings, deserve that. Natural rights. So Jefferson is going to say all men are created equal while he owns other human beings. The cat is out of the bag. Now human beings are going to have to be equal, even though it takes 89 years to happen in the United States. That's over. So things are beginning to change and morph in the world, and the American Revolution is leading that change of how these ideas are moving. So the assumption of democracy is that these people are going to come together and create a republic. They mean of an elite, almost like the example that kind of we inherit from Greece and to a lesser extent Rome. But the people are going to fight and die and win this war are so-called ordinary people, and they're going to deserve something. So you can say that democracy is not an object of the American Revolution. It's a consequence of it. And there's a big difference of that, and we are all the beneficiaries of that big difference.
So obviously lots of voices, reenactments, footage over 9 years of work. We hear a number of very familiar celebrity voices. How do you think this series is different from any other documentary you've done?
Well, you know, first of all, and it goes back to what Sarah and you were talking about with the violence. You know, if you've got the photographs, if you've got the newsreels, the violence is proven. But if you've got a painting and somebody's got a bayonet and maybe there's even a little trickle of blood, they seem different for us. They are very much like us. So I think this is a story about how you tell the real story of the revolution and you get under the surface of it and forget the distance and time. And a lot of it is doing reenactments. A lot of it is asking the finest actors in the world to read off camera. And I think we have the better cast than any film that's ever been made or television series ever that helped bring alive not just the familiar top-down folks, and you get to know Washington a little bit better with more dimension, but dozens, scores of other people that you've never heard of. Sometimes they're teenagers. Sometimes they're Native American. Sometimes they're free or enslaved black people here, or women who are half the population and are central to the success of the revolution and to keeping the resistance alive, whose stories aren't told, but also all the other players in this global struggle. The French, the Dutch, the Spanish, the English, all of their soldiers, all of their kings, all of their ministers. And so what you do is by having all of these different voices, you give a sense that this is what really took place. And instead of putting your thumb on one side or the other, you're an umpire calling balls and strikes, then everybody's got their play. Everybody understands their role in it, and you can make it the complex, I think, most interesting story we've ever tried to tell.
Mm-hmm. So we've got another clip, this one about the belief of those who are fighting for their independence. Here's that.
I think to believe in America, rooted in the American Revolution, is to believe in possibility. That, to me, is the extraordinary thing about the patriot side of the fight. I think everybody on every side, including people who were denied even the ownership of themselves, had the sense of possibility worth fighting for.
So, Sarah, when watching the film, there are times that you would expect the British to prevail in a particular battle. And that's kind of what, you know, we all learned in fifth grade as well, you know, a very well-trained and organized army. And, you know, you expect them to win the battle and then the war. But, of course, that's not always what happens. And it's, we know that history has written what actually has happened. What does that say about, you know, the Americans who called themselves patriots at the time? Were they misunderstood?
I don't think the Patriots were misunderstood as much as I think we don't understand how absolutely unlikely it was that we were going to win, how surprising it was that we were going to win, that we were able to throw off the biggest, most mighty military power in the world with the greatest navy in the world, and we actually wouldn't have done that without the French. But I think the Patriots were very successful as they moved from 1775 to 1781 down the Eastern Seaboard in rallying support, inspiring people. I think the words of our declaration were meaningful. I think the war, nobody knew how it was going to turn out while it was being fought. So we look back on it with a lot of ideas, and I think we overlay the revolution even more than our other wars and our other moments in history with, as Ken often says, a kind of sentimentality, and where it's a distance because of the paintings, because of it's 250 years ago, and the people who we know come down to us in these paintings with wigs, and, you know, they were young revolutionaries making it up as they went. They didn't know how it was going to turn out. The people on the ground didn't know how it was going to turn out, and it is really unlikely that we were able to do what we did.
Tell me, Sarah, a little bit about the importance of the Native American nations, yeah, as well as black people, African Americans, mm-hmm, be they free or enslaved, for both sides of this war.
So I think, you know, you can't tell a story of America without widening the lens to see who is actually living here and who was fighting the war and who, if the whatever way the war went, was going to be impacted by it. And so in any film we make, we want to widen the lens and have people think about who's on the ground in the house next door to you, who lives down the street. And the Native American populations were vast and different, and there were hundreds of them, and they were not a monolith, just like no population is a monolith. And the free black people were all different, and the enslaved black, and people made all kinds of very reasonable and rational decisions that, again, we look back and judge and moralize about, when in fact it was very reasonable to side with the British, it was very reasonable to be a patriot, and it was very reasonable to say, what does this have to do with me, and get out of the way, as we see even today.
Speaking of today, because we are living through a tumultuous time, of course, which there's this, you know, bitter political division in the country right now. Ken, as you were working on this film, was there any period, you know, of that deep division that you felt still resonates today?
Well, I think, first of all, the one we're covering, the American Revolution, is deep division. We began this when Barack Obama had 13 months to go in his presidency. So we've been watching the rhymes of history, the echoes of history change as we've done it. But here's the central thing. When a person is in a struggle, having great difficulty, they go to a professional, and the professional wants to ask an essential question. Where are you from? Tell me your story. Tell me about your parents. How did you get to where you are right now? Because that's the way we're going to unravel what's going on right now, the difficulty you're having. So if you go back in a time of great division and internal turmoil for an entire country, you go back to your origin story and find out where you begin, you might be able to find the pieces in which it's, you're less thrown out by how much division is. There's always been division, but you might find the path back to how you solve that. So we're hoping that if anything this story does is help put the us back in the U.S. and permit us a chance to celebrate the glories of what we invented. This is the most important event in world history since the birth of Christ. It changed the way people were. Everybody was a subject up until then, and all of a sudden there were people who were citizens, and the great responsibility that entails, that's about as inspiring a story as I know, and maybe it helps us get back to a place where there's less of that hand-wringing, less of the sky is falling, less of the sense of, oh, it's so bad right now. It's been really bad. It was bad in the Revolution, a civil war. It was bad during our civil war. It's been bad at lots of different places that we've covered in the work that we've done together. And so I think there's a fundamental optimism. When you study the past, there's also a fundamental sort of psychological therapy that takes place. If we learn our origin story, we can help us get through this and begin to move on to the next great phase, which is repair.
All right, around the corner. it has been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you both, Ken Burns and Sarah Botstein. Thank you so much for joining us. Congrats on the documentary series.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And The American Revolution premieres on Sunday, November 16th. It will air on consecutive nights through Friday. And we're back right after this. And that is our show for this Thursday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for The Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.